we have removed as much of the contamination as possible, and the area is sealed over with heavy coats of paint to prevent possible spread. And I see they're back to keeping the gate closed. Earlier this year, that was always open when we got here. So I will step out and open the gate.
Story in the news today.
You believe in ghosts and the paranormal?
Are they UFOs, or are they like some crazy experimental, you know, governmental?
I don't know.
Planes that they're building.
Police in Española are catching more than just criminals. They're catching images of what they believe are ghosts.
There's this weird animal-like creature that was shot, wolf-like creature that just stood out in some odd ways.
And welcome to Strange Uncles. I'm Shane.
I'm a billionaire with a green goblin fetish stalking a Peruvian village.
I was going to bring that shit up. God damn you to beat me to the punch. Oh, my God. I know this isn't a news episode, but at the same time, you know, I've been like texting you and John the shit that's happened in Peru. This stuff is weird. I mean, I believe in aliens, I think, more than what the latest shit they're saying is happening. I'm like, my God, you know.
Turns out Peru's just a wildlife reserve for billionaires. Just kidding. Peru's a lovely country.
Yeah, exactly. Well, and so you guys are in the know again, this is not a news episode. We got a pretty, I think it was pretty fair write-up, but just to kind of poke fun and keep you in the know, there's shit happening in Peru, evidently. So if you listeners aren't on top of it, get on top of it. It's kind of funny. I guess the local villagers there's a mythical creature that's in their culture called like a face ripper or a face splitter or eater or some shit like that.
I think they said the face peelers.
Face peelers, that's what it is. Yeah, yeah. So it's some kind
very
of
very metal, cult. Very, very motorcycle clubbish.
No shit, right? Very apocalyptic type thing, you know? So between that and their culture, they're seeing, like, the villagers are saying these giant green goblin armored fucking aliens are taking people and, like, ripping their faces off and killing them, and they're seeing them and all this other stuff. Now, the twist is, somebody's saying, oh, no, there's a bunch of mines, and rich people own these mines and the gorillas and all that, and so they're flying around in spacesuits with green bulletproof vests, and that's what the Peruvians are seeing. Like, this story just keeps turning and turning. I don't fucking know where to go with it.
Yes, security, mine security with jetpacks, definitely is more plausible.
Plausible, right? Yeah, yeah. We're gonna go with Plan B on that one.
I mean, that's like everyone that was saying that when the Spanish ship showed up in the New World, quote unquote, that the natives didn't see them because the ship boggled their imagination or whatever, like that.
Yeah, yeah.
So they just didn't see it. It's like, what the fuck kind of bullshit is that? Anyway,
it's fucking crazy.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure that your average person in a Peruvian village would still like recognize a dude in like a plate carrier and not think it was a spooky alien, even if he had like night vision goggles and shit on.
Yeah, dude. I mean, I know that maybe they're not. You know, look, Peru is not a first world country. I get that. But we're not like 300 years ago. They got to know that they got to see airplanes and shit, right? I mean, I just like, goddamn
it. You're making cities. It's a developed country.
It is a developed country, right? It's not, anyway, fucking whatever. But it's fun. So, yeah, if you listeners want a quick laugh, just type in Peru goblins or whatever. I'm sure something will pop up on Google. It's interesting, but fucking funny at the same time. Anyway, so with that being said, hey, strangers, hopefully everything's cool. So we got a write-up, and I guess, I don't know, Josh, you know, let me, so I've been working on this for a while, and we covered some things in regards to this, like the whole, you know, war, we've covered CIA, we cover some other things, the whole nuclear history that are, not only our country, but I guess the world back when, to me, it's fascinating. I know you're interested in it, too, like it's just, we went from point A with fucking with something that we had no clue would even work. You know, if you guys haven't seen Oppenheimer, check out Oppenheimer. I went to see it, and the wife said, okay, it's for research. That's how I got to go see it. But great show. Fantastic. Literally worried about, you know, igniting the fucking atmosphere on fire on this.
That was always my favorite thing. When I found that out, that like there was a pretty good chance, and they thought there was a pretty good chance that they might just burn the atmosphere. And they were like, well, fuck it. We got to do it anyway.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So it's a small like, chance.
Well, ain't small. That America. Ain't you that America, and me.
Right? It's all in it for the war, right? Well, and granted, you know, look, we're worried about Hitler. We're worried about Nazis. We're worried. And then come to find out at the end of it all, it, you know, nothing to do with Germans to a certain point. We focused our strategy somewhere else and ended the war. However, with that being said, as horrifying as it is, because it absolutely is, there's some great things that came from nuclear power, you know, and nuclear science and working in medicinal and driving Navy subs and just, you know, like it's been, it's amazing. And even to this day, I personally, you know, I don't know everything about nuclear energy, but I think still we need to learn how to harness it better. I think if we could figure shit out a little bit more, that's the way to go for energy, right?
Hopefully they can duplicate the cold fusion breakthroughs that had a few months ago, and we can go that way because the waste produced from fusion is way less than
from fission,
less dangerous than regular old fission.
Right. Good old fission. Right. Well, that's what we're going to be focusing on today. And then I will say a couple things too. I went to see Oppenheimer. I don't know. Did you get a chance to see Josh or did you go to Barbie? I'm not sure.
I have not seen it.
You have not seen it? No. Well worth it.
Sorry. Well worth it. I mean, the Meg 2 came out this weekend. So.
Oh, Jesus Christ.
Priorities.
In the trench or something. They advertised that. I'm like, wait, they did another one? I didn't even watch the first one. So anyway.
Oh, the first one's great, dude. The first one is like 10 times better than it has any right to be, and not just in a so bad it's good way, but in like it's actually a pretty fun movie.
That's funny. It's right up there to me with Sharknado, which you know you say I should watch too.
Sharknado just gotta, is the exact opposite on the end of the spectrum. Gotcha, it's like dumb as fuck, but it's hilarious, and it's dumb as fuck on purpose, so it's fun. The Meg is dumb, but it's also like it's closer to Jaws than Sharknado.
Oh, okay. Gotcha. Okay. That's a good way to sum it up. Well, you know, again, haven't seen it yet. You know, so if you guys haven't seen Oppenheimer, see it because it is pretty amazing. So that kind of lit the fire a little bit. And then when I was going through all this research to put this thing together, I found out like I'm typing shit in and 2.5 hours west east, I guess, or west southwest, something in the middle of nowhere in Washington State. Was the Hanford.
Somewhere in the desert.
Exactly, where nobody can go. I knew Hanford was there, but what I didn't know was that you still could tour the B reactor, which is the reactor where they made the plutonium for the bomb that dropped in Nagasaki. It was the world's first nuclear reactor ever. Full-blown. I get there's a mini one. We'll cover it in Chicago somewhere to prove the theory, but this is the first, like, they built this thing. It sits on 23 feet of concrete, Josh, number one, like, which is fucking insane. Mm. And then you see all the, I mean, it's crazy. So I'll try to put some pictures in the show notes. But I did that tour Friday. And it was mind-boggling to just walk through history and see it. I will say that some of the things that we can get into the thing of the write-up is, you know, they're going through the safety stuff. They're like, yeah, no guns, no da-da-da, no this, no that. Oh, and by the way, radiation. You know, even though it was a nuclear site and da-da-da. You know, there's certain areas that are roped off because they're not quite expunged yet. You know, and then the areas that you will be walking, there's multiple coats of paint to seal all that in. So you're perfectly safe. You're well below. And I'm like, wait, like when you paint lead paint over a house, what? So you it was a little unnerving.
I was just going to say, come on, Shane, you're of the greatest generation. You should be well used to lead paint.
Right. I did my whole childhood, right? So, Jesus. Anyway, I just thought that was kind of funny. And it was funny how he, like, literally, I felt like he lowered his breath when he said it. So, people in the back of the bus went in here. I don't know. Anyway, but it was a full-blown tour, full-blown bus, bathroom on board, screens. They had the mic. It was really cool. And it's free. It's actually part of the National Park Service. And they provide the tour. Yeah. And it's like a historical park. It's part of that. And and it's amazing. So, you know, in between the episodes, I might, you know, splatter. Again, you know, we're talking about Hanford a little bit because that's part of this. But for the Patreons, I did record the entire thing. I was able to. And so I'm going to put a companion piece together. So shortly after this episode drops, Patreon standby for that. It'll kind of go with it. And I just kind of recorded the tour and recorded questions and even brought the EMF meters, picked up some weird readings here and there, which just could be false wiring. I don't know. Anyway, but it was awesome.
That's your cue, listener, to join our Patreon at patreon.com/strangeuncles.
There you go. Cue number one. I'm sure there'll be a few in this episode. But anyway. So that's my thing, man. You got anything to add to that, or you want to jump into it?
No, I'm all curious and excited, aroused even.
Yeah. Oh, well, keep it over there, sir. Keep it over there. But no, it's cool. So we're going to jump into it, everybody. This actually is a write-up on the Manhattan Project. So again, we talked about the movie Oppenheimer out in the theaters. It just good timing, I think, more than anything, finally gave us the idea. We've been kicking this around for a while, and we finally decided, you know, let's put it out now. So that's what we're going to do. And we actually had a few Patreon members reaching out to ask for some of the background history of the whole nuclear time frame. Obviously, Oppenheimer focused a lot on Los Alamos, not really the other sites, and not really the whole key of the Manhattan Project as a whole thing. And that's what we're going to do here. So astonishing history, horrible history, but just knowing what it looked like for the key players and the key locations. Again, Oppenheimer worked with Los Alamos. There's so many other players and locations, over hundreds, by the way, of the Manhattan Project, which is crazy. And one of them I just talked about over in Washington, so over in my backyard. So the race to be the first one with a bomb is absolutely horrifying. Again, we won't state that this is, it's not, because it's horrible how we decided to basically make one of mankind's biggest creations and inventions and right away turn it into a weapon. Awful. But with that being said, it's fascinating too. You can add in the politics, you can add in the compartmentalization, you can add in the dense amount of the greatest brains ever, literally in one place. This all goes with the story, and it all adds to it. And so join us.
Fucking nerds.
I know, right? So join us as we talk about a strange snapshot in the country's history, all the obstacles we had to overcome to succeed, and whatever, I guess, succeed truly means when it comes to playing around with this kind of stuff that we didn't know anything about. So with that being said, open the gates.
Feverishly worked to push the boundaries of science and engineering to create an atomic bomb before Nazi Germany might do the same. Only a select few of the top scientists knew the purpose of the Manhattan Project. Others toiled in isolation, solely focused on their piece of the secret project. They knew they were helping the war effort, but few could have imagined they were producing materials for the world's first atomic weapons.
All right, so before we dive down the rabbit hole of the Manhattan Project, some brief, quick history, and again, quick, brief, we're not going to, there's more to it here, but on nuclear fission itself, we'll start there. We'll just give you guys an overrun of, hey, this is what they were playing with, and this is where it went to. So the discovery of nuclear fission actually was by German chemists Otto Hahn and Fritz Strassmann in 1938, and its theoretical explanation by Lisa Mittner and Otto Frisch made the development of the atomic bomb an actual theoretical possibility. You know, so that was in the 38 time frame. And of course, with everything else,
good old Germans.
Oh yeah, Germans always. Well, you know, like I said, they're a smart bunch of groups, right? Of course, with everything else, the concern that the Germans would beat us to the punch regarding the development of such a weapon was basically at the forefront. That's all really our country could focus at the time with. Many notables knew the power behind harnessing the atomic energy, or namely a nuclear weapon, was something we're not ready to play around with yet, needless to say. But in August 1939, Hungarian-born physicists Leo Szilard and Eugene Wigner drafted the Einstein-Szilard letter, which warned of the potential development of extremely powerful bombs of a new type. They had it signed by Albert Einstein, basically because nobody knew them, and they knew he was a pacifist. They knew he had history, right? And he had a reputation. So bringing him on board with that letter was key, because then people are paying attention, right? Not just these two
guys. Yeah, he was the king nerd.
Oh, exactly. Yeah. Number one for sure. So anyway, the letter was done. They did this whole petition thing, and then they delivered it to President Franklin D. Roosevelt. Roosevelt put together an advisory committee on uranium to investigate the issues raised by the letter. A meeting was held on the 21st of October, 1939, which was attended by Szilard, Wigner, and one Edward Teller. His name's going to pop up here and there. The committee reported back to Roosevelt in November that uranium would provide a possible source of bombs with a destructiveness vastly greater than anything now known. And, man, just reading that sentence, you're like, holy shit, that's huge. I mean, I wonder what Roosevelt was thinking. Anyway, you know, I mean, this is a... Anyway, we digress. But that's kind of how this thing started and how some of the research around it started. So,
indeed. Well, despite the warnings compiled in the report, In February 1940, the Navy awarded Columbia University $6,000 whole dollars in funding to start experimenting with fission, which in today's dollars would be roughly $130,000, which is still yeah. nothing.
Yeah, yeah.
They did manage to create the first nuclear fission in the country, with Zillard being part of that group. Also, a gentleman by the name of Enrico Fermi, mm-hmm. Booth, and Dunning. While the Columbia team was working on building mini reactors without the effect they had hoped, the Advisory Committee on Uranium soon became the National Defense Research Committee, or NDRC, and invested more money into research. Many of them agreed that more research had to be done, and so Roosevelt signed an executive order to create another group, the Office of Scientific Research and Development, or OSRD for short, to study more in depth the uranium isotope as well as plutonium, which was discovered at the University of California that same year. Hmm. The office was empowered to engage in large engineering projects in addition to research. The NDRC Committee on Uranium became the S1 section of the OSRD. The word uranium was dropped from the secretary reasons, for security reasons, go figure. So while other countries like Britain were making breakthroughs in atomic research, the U.S. was spinning its wheels a bit, just, you know, fucking around.
Yeah.
In July 1940, Britain had offered to give the U.S. access to its scientific research and briefed American scientists on British developments. They soon found out that the American project was smaller than the British and not as far along, which is a rarity.
It's USA. Surprising. Yeah, right on this time.
Right? You win this time, Britain. On October 9th, 1941, Roosevelt approved the atomic program, and he created a top policy group consisting of himself, although he never attended a meeting. Roosevelt chose the Army to run the project rather than the Navy because the Army had more experience with management of large-scale construction projects. He also agreed to coordinate the effort with that of the British, and on the 11th of October, he sent a message to Prime Minister Winston Churchill, making sure they were brothers in arms from here on in. So as far as the Manhattan Project, this is where we get into the meat and potatoes.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. And there's more about this Leslie Groves character we're gonna talk about here. Which is when they say the Army, he's going to be the key player in the Army. We'll get into it, but I learned a little bit more on the tour.
He was a general, right?
He was, but he was also a structural engineer beforehand. Kind of cool. When we get into it, I might stop and just add some, you know, when they talk about the tour, I didn't know really how involved he was into the whole thing. Oppenheimer shows him, you know, he's really involved in Los Alamos, but the whole project was just crazy how you pick one guy and go, hey, you're in charge of something we've never done before. Go. I mean, just holy shit, right? Anyway, so fun fact, Josh. It was rumored, but pretty much proven, that the idea of pursuing the Manhattan Project was talked about at Bohemian Grove. So if you guys have never heard of the Bohemian Grove, it's well worth looking up. Basically, kind of in a nutshell, it's a meeting had in California Forest every year, and it's been going on for over 100 years. Only the rich and powerful would be allowed to be part of it. And it is crazy. Actually, I think, I want to say we almost covered it, or I read about it or something. Anyway.
I'm pretty sure we covered it.
I think we did. Didn't we do an episode?
We covered it at least a little bit when we talked about, was it American Madness? Was that?
That's where. Yep. That we did. The crazy guy that broke into Bohemian
Grove. Yeah, Tease book.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
It's amazing. Unless, look, and I know that there was rumors of, you know, well, all kinds of shit. Again, alleged reports of all kinds of dastardly things from rape to drunkenness. But I don't know. You know, we digress.
It's nothing to do with that. Source of a lot of your, like, rich people cabal.
Yeah, for sure.
Conspiracies.
For sure. Yeah. Well, and come on. They dance around in cloaks with a giant burning owl. I mean, that's a little odd. Just saying.
I mean, that sounds like trying to think of the PC way of saying really dumb frat boy stuff.
Very true. Yeah. And that maybe that's all it is. But anyway, that's Bohemian Grove in a nutshell. Look it up. It's kind of cool. And even though the motto for the Bohemian Grove is Weaving Spiders Come Not Here, which basically means this is a place to just get ripped out of your mind, hopefully get laid, fucking whatever.
Yo, we're just here to drink and fuck, no business.
Basically, yeah, pretty much. But and you and I are supposed to discuss business. However, that was rarely the case because, look, human nature, especially you get rich fuckers that have no morals in one group and they have a lot of pull and a lot of prestige, you can't tell me they're not going to take the opportunity to talk amongst themselves, right?
Having been a businessman, I can attest to the fact that it is incredibly hard to get business people to not talk about business.
Absolutely. Yeah, no, 100%. I know, like, it is. It's a thing. It is. So let's just say that we kind of believe this probably happened. Anyway, to say that, so the story goes that the meeting took place in September 1942, which had that would be become the key players involved in the whole atomic era. So Ernest Lawrence, Robert Oppenheimer, which, you know, we'll discuss, we talked about, the S1 committee, head honchos, all those guys. And keep in mind, too, Oppenheimer at the time was not directly involved with S1 yet. He was kind of an outlier, but again, he plays a big role. So we'll talk about him later. The presidents of Harvard, Yale, and Princeton, of course. And then to top everything off, reps from the Standard Oil and General Electric, and a sprinkling of various military officials. So you have this group.
Those dickheads.
Right? Yeah, all talking about everything. And again, Oppenheimer wasn't a member at the time, but the Lawrence and Oppenheimer hosted the meeting. Right? I think Oppenheimer had a lot of respect and prestige. Pretty egotistical for the most part, but people looked up to him because they knew he was a fucking genius. And so there was that. Grove members took pride. They actually take pride in this event, and they often relate the story to new attendees, allegedly. So they kind of, hey, yeah, the Manhattan Project actually stemmed from, you know, and that's
did the way you know?
I guess. I don't know. Anyway, so just to catch everybody back up, Fermi and Szilard were still engaged in research on nuclear chain reactions, now working out of the University of Chicago, and was successful in enriching uranium to produce uranium-235. Meanwhile, scientists like Glenn Seaborg were producing microscopic samples of pure plutonium, and the Canadian government and military officials were working on nuclear research at several sites in Canada. While all that was going on behind the curtains, the threat of Hitler mastering the same technology and using it, because he fucking would have, became the biggest fear on the proverbial table. So in December of 1942, Roosevelt approved the founding of the Manhattan Project. It was led by the United States with the support of the United Kingdom and Canada, and facilities were set up in remote locations in New York, Mexico, Tennessee, and Washington, as well as various sites in Canada, all over Canada, actually. So from 1942 to 1946, the project was under the direction of Major General Leslie Groves of the U.S. Army of Engineers, who had just built a little fucking building. I don't know if you heard of this building or not. He just got done constructing the Pentagon. I don't know if that rings a bell, kind of a thing.
I want to say that was the largest construction project
at the time.
At its time.
Yeah, huge. I mean, for him, that undertaking, again, that's why I say...
I want to say it had more concrete. Than the Hoover Dam or something like that.
I think so. I think I heard rumors I could like be that.
Fucking completely making that up. So yeah. I don't know.
Yeah. Well,
fact checked me or some shit. But
there you go. Well, here's it. So let's talk a little bit off note about Leslie Groves. Some I found out in the tour. Number one, he was a genius. I mean, the guy, as far as a structural engineer goes, that's really what he was first and foremost. So he built the Pentagon because it was his opportunity to show what he was worth, which is cool, right? Like anybody would do. And then what he was really hoping for at the end of the day was a warfare gig. That's what he wanted to do. He wanted to work up. This is what he wanted to become. He wanted to become a general, and he wanted to be, you know, at the front of whatever that war meant, because he wanted to see the action. He wanted to be a big part of that. And the guys above him basically said, no, you know what? We're going to put you over here on this little thing called the Manhattan Project. You're not going to be, you know, in the trenches, but this is the most important thing the country has ever approached.
Turns out you're really good at running work crews, and we kind of need that more than we
basically
need another guy running fucking battalions.
Yeah, 100%. Well, he was pissed off about it. He's kind of disappointed because that's not what he wanted. But at the end of the day, holy shit, his name is splashed throughout history and will never go away. So, you know, at least he has quite a legacy, if you will.
Right? He's like, I wanted to get in on the more straightforward war crimes, not the, the ones that can blatant. Be contested. Yeah, yeah.
Jesus Christ. Anyway, so a little background on this Groves character. So the nuclear physicist J. Robert Oppenheimer was the director of the Los Alamos laboratory that designed the bombs, and Los Alamos was also the place where Oppenheimer was working on something called Project Y, which was just before the Manhattan Project was formed. It kind of got enveloped into the Manhattan Project. They had all these code names before they realized, okay, let's just call it this. Before they had like Project Y and Project M.
Too many goddamn code names. I can't keep them all straight. Jesus
Christ, right? Yeah, everything. There's only, what, 26 letters in the fucking alphabet, so come on, folks. Anyway, the Army component was designated by the Manhattan District as its first headquarters were in. Right? Wait for it, Manhattan. Duh.
Oh, hey, that makes sense. Yeah. I thought they were being clever since the project was nowhere near Manhattan.
Not at all. No cleverness here at all. But the name gradually superseded the official code name. Right, exactly. Development of substitute materials, which was what was called prior, just doesn't really have the same ring to it. You know. So, anyway.
No, it doesn't.
Manhattan Project is a name. That's what it was named, and that's a history. So there you have it. So.
All right. Well, so... onto the meat and potatoes of the whole affair, just how this whole thing got off the ground. The project used uranium ore, so we're going to have a little chemistry lesson, I think, right here. Most of it coming from a mine in what is now the Democratic Republic of the Congo, which is kept secret from the Germans.
Yeah.
Oh, hey. Okay. Weird, we didn't want them knowing where that was.
Crazy.
The project was conducted in the U.S., primarily at three top secret towns. Oak Ridge, Tennessee, where uranium was enriched until it was radioactive enough for nuclear fission. Hanford, Washington, where Shane went, where reactors transformed uranium into plutonium and even more powerful nuclear fuel. And Los Alamos, New Mexico, where Oppenheimer directed the laboratory that designed and built experimental atomic bombs. And we'll cover each of these locations and behind the curtains here in a minute. At Manhattan Project's peak, they employed nearly 140,000 people, but due to high turnover, the number of people that were involved in one way or another is closer to 600,000. I wonder if that high turnover was people dying from radiation poisoning.
So I dug into this a little bit. They don't at well, go figure. They don't. Nothing I found actually came right out of set. But so I asked this question specifically at the B reactor tour, and I said, "Look, because one of the guys that did the tour, which was really again not to get too off the subject, but he actually was a nuclear scientist back in the 80s. So they shut the B reactor tour down in 68 for the last time. They had like five other reactors going in the Hanford area, and then they kind of systematically mothballed them." And so he worked there. He knew there. Now he's kind of semi-retired doing this tour. So he knows the history. And I asked him point blank. I'm like, dude, you know, was there ever a critical instance here? Any kind of a where? And he was kind of quiet, kind of tongue-tied. He says, yes, there were several that we
what
shouldn't.
What am I allowed to say?
Exactly. I'm sure he's been asked that before. So I'm sure he was trying to, you know, present it the best way possible without getting fired. But it seems to me like, yes, absolutely. I think some of that turnover too, and we'll get into it, was they were trying to keep this as under wraps as possible. Again, you initially have, you know, 140,000 people. Due to the turnover, it balloons to 600,000. Nobody's going to say anything. You know, I think some of that was between worrying about spies, worrying about people saying something. Families couldn't take it anymore, so they're out and somebody else is in. There's so many various factors of why it ballooned to 600. For sure. But, you know, I mean, all legitimate, right? At the end of the day.
Yeah. I was mostly just kidding about the radiation.
Oh, actually, I wasn't, because honestly, that I'm sure that there was some shit. I mean, I'm sure there was some, I mean, my God, we're playing.
I'm sure there were a few, like,
with, you know,
safety steps they didn't know they needed to take or that got skipped. And I'm sure a few people got sick, but,
So here it is. Here's a little tidbit too, before we get too far into it, but touring the reactor and this, I'm talking about the one in Hanford, how they designed it is literally you're looking at this huge 1500 small little tubes where they put the fuel in. So there's a front of the reactor and there's a back of the reactor, and the reactor is like almost 30 feet deep pretty much. And so when you're in the front of the reactor, the tubes come in these little aluminum sleeves and they're capped. And they get them shipped across. They were shipping across country back and forth with no hazards, no safety, no nothing, because they were in these sleeves and they were fine. So everybody working in the front of the reactor that would load through these tubes, almost like a vacuum tube is what it was like. They would load these things, no gloves, no safety, no nothing, because there was nothing hazardous in the front. But after it went through the nuclear reaction process, turned it in from uranium-235, I think, to 238, and then to plutonium, and then into plutonium, then they would push them basically out of each tube every 4 to 6 weeks. And those tubes, then they're a problem. Then they drop into this 20-foot bath of water that was from the Columbia River, which is fucking, they built this thing. You can literally, if you have a strong arm, you could throw a fucking rock into the river from the Hanford site. Like, it's that close. The Columbia River. Sense. And so I'm like, holy shit. And now they got, like, barrels leaking and everything. Anyway, that's another fucking story altogether. But how they did it was just weird. So in the front, there was no safety at all. They didn't need to. But at the same time, I feel like, no, there probably was some glitches there that they should have, you know.
Well, I was mostly just thinking of all those poor gals that were using the tritium paint or whatever to paint the the hands on watches so they'd glow in the dark for the soldiers.
Jesus
and
Christ,
they were like told to just like use their wet the brushes with their mouths, and they all got like cancer and all their fucking jaws fell off and shit a few years later.
I forgot all about that. I mean, so it's weird how it said it, but absolutely. I think, you know, even though you were joking, I don't want to go too far down the path, but I think there was probably some things.
I'm sure there were at least a few quote-unquote minor incidents.
Right.
Anyway, the cost, nearly $2 billion, equivalent to about $24 billion in 2021. So they did invest it, and eventually they invested a pretty hefty chunk of change into this. Over 90% of the cost was for building factories and to produce fissile material, with less than 10% for development and production of the weapons, which is interesting. To add, research and production was also taking place at more than 30 sites across the United States, the United Kingdom, and Canada. But the key to the success, or lack of it at times, we'll cover that later, was the compartmentalization of the whole thing. People literally working in one in the next room had no clue what the people in the room across the hall were doing. Signs were put up at the gates with sayings such as, "What you see here, what you do here, what you hear here, when you leave here, let it stay here."
Jesus.
Because everything stays in Vegas.
Right.
All over the background of the infamous three monkeys with their, you know, the hear no evil, see no evil, speak no evil monkeys. Dude, that's one of my favorite categories of like World War II propaganda, though, from like all sides. The recruitment posters and the security stuff is
crazy. And even walking in the because they have a place called the Reflection Hall or something in the reactor, and they have the old signs like you were talking about. And there's one that looks like I want to say like Darth Vader, if you have to put a name on it. Obviously, way before Darth Vader, but has this weird black cloak with the eyes, and they're looking over the wall, and it's like, he sees you, like, just shit that is, my God, you know, what is going on?
Well, it's here? Like, the art style is something that I think is really cool looking, but also, like, the slogans and stuff they would put on it, which I'm sure didn't sound as silly and cheesy in the lexicon of the 1940s as it does today, but, like...
Agreed.
You know, like the whole, what you do here, what you see here, what you hear here, let it stay here.
Yeah, it's
shut the fuck up.
It's insane. It is. So there's so many stuff to it. But anyway, we're going to take a quick break, folks, and then we will continue to break things down. We're getting into kind of the fun stuff where we talk about the sites individually. And some of these numbers it blew my fucking mind. I'm sure it'll blow your guys's too. You know, just the money involved. So we'll take a break. Stand by.
Believe in UFOs? Felt that chill up your spine that you just can't explain? Contemplate the other side of reality? Do you shake your head at the world that seems to have lost its common sense? Well, look no further than Strange Uncles. Find them on all podcast platforms and call their hotline to tell your side of reality at 801-252-6945. Open the gates.
All right, and we are back. So let's do another fun fact, shall we? So the project was estimated to be consuming over half of all Army construction labor and steel production, and the Oak Ridge site in Tennessee alone used around 1% of the electrical power produced for the entire fucking country. That's pretty big. I mean, just say, I know 1%, but for the entire country?
Yeah.
Anyway, the Manhattan Project was responsible for the generation of thousands of new inventions, as represented by patent claims processed in secret by the project, which, if filed, would have represented some 1% of all patents in force at the end of World War II. Again, another number which is crazy. And while much attention has been given to the big three project production sites, we mentioned them, Hanford, Los Alamos, Oak Ridge, the total project sites across the United States number into the hundreds, literally, including work done over 24 universities. It was not merely a scientific research project or a race to create the biggest, most devastating weapon ever. It created an entirely new industry as well as a military coordination required to mobilize its byproducts as usable weapons, all under an unusually heavy cloak of military and governmental secrecy. And so, yeah, you know, you got a lot of hands in the cookie jar here, and just, you know, numbers on the side when they're working through what this looks like is mind-boggling. And another thing we'll cover briefly is the time frame that it took to build these cities, get them on the map, get them rolling, and then have people in there working on what we're doing. I mean, it would take, I don't even know if we could pull this off today. I don't think we could, just because of,
well, these are like the design. American version of the Soviet closed.
Oh yeah.
Cities, right?
Absolutely.
Except for yep. that we don't try and like pretend they don't exist.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's another whole thing too. Like the ones you're talking about, the ones that like, it actually looks like a city, storefronts. They have meat in the cases, but nobody lives there. They were just,
oh no, weird... no. People live there. They just like,
oh,
they're not on the map. And you need special permission to go or leave.
Oh, gotcha.
Because they're set up for like purposes like this.
Yeah, like they're doing their own research and stuff. Yeah, it's absolutely crazy. So let's break down each side a bit, just give you an idea what each was responsible for. And we will start, why not? We'll start in Oak Ridge, Tennessee. Okay. So, quote, Oak Ridge attacks Japan. That was a headline in a local Tennessee newspaper the day after the bomb was created. There was dropped on Hiroshima. So basically, the day after this, what this newspaper said, it wasn't Oak Ridge that did it, but holy shit! If you're working there and you didn't know what you're working on, you read that headline, it's a thing, right? But we're going to back up a little bit on this. So Groves, who we mentioned earlier, and he'll pop up here and there, he was a prime drive for why each site was picked. Several reasons went into Oak Ridge decisions. First off, remote location. I mean, it's, you know, hands bar for all these sites, the same thing. Groves wanted to ensure that the Manhattan Project kept a low profile and Oak Ridge's rural location fit that bill to a T. The fact that Tennessee is a landlocked state located away from the coast reduced the chance that the Germans or Japanese would actually be able to bomb the nuclear site. Secondly, it's population. East Tennessee had just the right amount of people for the Manhattan Project's purposes. On one hand, the military was looking for an area that was not too densely populated because it was concerned about the potential dangers of building its industrial plants. The proposed nuclear site in East Tennessee would only displace about 1,000 families. But on the other hand, the Manhattan Project needed enough people to work at the new plants. So fortunately, the nearby city of Knoxville, which boasted around 112,000 residents, was ripe for pickings for all the labor recruitment they needed. And I'm sure they offered them a pretty penny to go there, too, I would think. I mean, you know, you're already, what, $24 billion into this, right? So, anyway.
Well, and you got to remember that these public work projects were a big part of what that coupled with war spending are what got America out of the Great Depression, pretty much.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah,
I mean?
Pretty much.
Like, the public works projects were helping, and then the war started, and all the money that got dumped into, you know, the defense industry and everything, and all the jobs that were required to, you know, make the ships and build the bombers and all that kind of stuff. That is what really pulled us out of the Depression. That and a huge fucking wealth tax.
Well, and 100%. And look, you know, after World War II, you know, we were shit for the first time. Our country, you know, the man went to work. The wife could be a stay-at-home mom, brand new house. Suburbs were invented, da-da-da-da-da-da-da. Like, that's all the after effect of all this stuff, right? So, yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm. I think we lucked out, you know, like this worked well. But, again, in the thick of things, you know, maybe that wasn't quite seen at first, right? But... In the beginning, the Manhattan Project planned on building four different types of production plants, pile, electromagnetic, gaseous diffusion, and centrifuge, all at one site. But at the end of the day, the centrifuge process was abandoned just because it wasn't, it was too lengthy. It was too, it just wasn't working. It wouldn't, it's not feasible, basically. But the original plan is construct all four plants in the same vicinity contributed to East Tennessee's appeal. The electromagnetic, gaseous diffusion, and thermal diffusion plants all required significant amounts of electricity, which could be found at the Tennessee Valley Authority hydroelectric plants at Norris Dam. East Tennessee also offered good quality water and ample land for the project. And as an added bonus, the land was cheap. So get this shit. Only $48 per acre on average. Not that the military were pinching pennies, but, you know, it helped. But they still, I mean, they're throwing a lot of, I'm sure there was some open checks here for this fucking thing. And this attributed to it, right? So.
Yeah, and I'm sure that they claimed eminent domain wherever they needed to slash could. And absolutely, with eminent domain, they just pay market value, but they decide what that is.
Well,
you know what I mean? Like usually when you... When the government of any level comes in and says they're claiming eminent domain and that they're going to force you out of your property, they pay you next to nothing for it.
Which is so, and again, you're 100% right there. We'll use Hanford for an example because they threw out some figures about what they, when they took over Hanford, and again, we'll cover it, it's like 46,000 something acres. But the local farmers and the ranchers and the tribes, mind you, they offered them what they thought was a fair amount value for their land. And the fucking farmers and ranchers are like, fuck you. There's no way I'm going to get my land for that. And so for years, there was actually land disputes over Hanford. So even though they built the, you know, they built the, you know, on Hanford, what it was, the supposed acreage they were going to get in the backside never happened because they spent years going back and forth. They even had like prisoners because they plucked these farmers and ranchers when they finally made deals where they could and got them out. You know, these guys are like, wait a minute, we have like orchards and shit. We got apples. We got the thing. We have to still maintain our stuff. And so they, and this isn't in the write-up. I found this out in the tour. So they brought in low-level prisoners that were at a prison nearby Hanford to basically for 2 years pick the crops, basically. So the farmers and ranchers wouldn't lose their shit and it could go back into the market and all that other stuff. So, you know, they had these prisoners like pick the apples and pick everything and just maintain shit for 2 years around the Hanford site, you know, just fucking. And then the poor tribe, the Wanapum tribe, completely upended, you know. And so when you do that tour,
probably not for the first time.
Oh, I know. Well, yeah, let's not talk about shitty fucking history too much. We're already into this. But where the Hanford site is, there was an actual town called Hanford and a town called White Bluffs. And again, I learned this on the tour. Both of them completely destroyed. So when we actually go to the site, there was this little rock shack building out by the river. Like it just maybe it was a 10 by 20 at the most. But it was one of the only original buildings left because it used to be on the Hanford Ranch. And that's what the government came in and went, nope, snip, I'll take that from you. And you could still see some of these old ranch buildings and stuff around that they just basically took over and confiscated and kicked, you know, the town of Hanford became nothing other than what the Hanford site was, which we'll get into the recreational side of it a little bit. You know, because again, you got whole families here going fucking stir crazy for 2 years plus, and they needed some kind of outlet. So even at the speed that they built these things, we'll cover the sites, but it just phenomenal. And it wiped this town of White Bluff clear off the fucking map. It doesn't even exist anymore. You know, just, I don't know, just fucking shitty, you know, you know, eminent domain, like you said, that's one thing.
It's a hell of a thing.
Yep. Yep.
Anyway, so, they pulled the pin on that bad dude and let her rip. The U.S. Army Corps of Engineer purchased 59,000 acres of land along the Clinch River, originally known as Site X or Clinton Engineer Works. The nuclear site was eventually renamed Oak Ridge. With its promise of jobs, the new city drew in tens of thousands of families, becoming the fifth largest city in Tennessee almost overnight. Like we mentioned earlier, compartmentalization was the key. The Oak Ridge was a prime example of this. Few people in town were aware that the military was pursuing an atomic bomb on site. They only knew information relevant to their specific job duties. It wasn't until the attacks on Hiroshima and Nagasaki in 1945 that the true purpose of the secret site became clear to the masses. So Jesus. What part of the Manhattan Project was Oak Ridge focused on, you may ask? The K-25 S-50 and Y-12 and plants were each built in Oak Ridge to separate the fissile isotope uranium-235 from the natural uranium, which consists almost entirely of the isotope uranium-238, which is not as gnarly.
Yeah. It's weird the numbers they have on these things. You know, uranium, just fucking the name alone. Crazy. Well, fun fact. Yeah. So, during construction of the electromagnets required for the uranium separation process at the Y-12 site, a shortage of copper forced them to borrow 14,700 tons of silver bullion from the United States Treasury as a copper substitute in wire for the electromagnet coils. As far as town design, the architecture firm Skidmore, Owings, and Merrill were contracted to provide the layout for the town and house designs. John Merrill was the architect company hired. He moved there to orchestrate the build, and in a little over 2 years, a city was born. So here's some facts. Fucking crazy. With 300 miles of roads, 55 miles of railroad track, 10 schools, 7 theaters, 17 restaurants, 13 supermarkets, a library, a sporting facility, church services for 17 denominations, but no airport for obvious reasons. We don't want a fucking airport next to this thing.
Sure.
But all those numbers, at the height of construction, a building was put up every 30 minutes.
Damn, like, fuck. That's, you know, that's fast. That's a lot fast. Of people too, because it's I don't think your typical construction crew had like a portable air compressor and like fucking nail guns and shit. I think they were doing a lot of this pretty manually at that time still.
For sure. I'm gonna flag it. You want to go ahead and so we're on 5 and we're like on the 45 minute mark. You want to split it now? Does that sound
sure?
Does that sound good?
Is it a good spot, or would it be better to get through like talking about the towns?
You know, so we got Los Alamos up next, and then Hanford up next. I think maybe I want to talk about a couple things with like how they, you know, what I learned on the tour. I can talk about that. Actually, I want to talk about one thing about Nagasaki real quick, and then the part two, we can launch into Los Alamos, Hanford, and then the bomb, because that's when things kind of, it goes quick after that point.
Okay.
I don't know. What's your thoughts?
No, that works. I just was wondering if it was a weird place to split it just because we just talked about Oak Ridge and then maybe go through the rest of it. But if you think it's better to hold off, that's fine.
You want to do half of Los Alamos?
No, I think we should do it all or split it here.
Okay.
Not all right. Do the whole thing, but do all right. Let's
split it here. And you know what? I'm looking at my time and I think, you know, let's just record another. If we have like 2 40-45 minute episodes, perfect. I think that'll
sure.
I think
that'll, yeah, that'll work.
Okay, cool. So let's do that. Okay. So I marked that time. Let me get back. All right. Yeah. It's just crazy for that kind of stuff. So this is where we're going to end it, but only because we're going to do this part tour here because we're going to go into the other sites. We're going to go into some after effects of, you know, when they made the weapon, made the bomb. That's all going to be in part two. I will say, before I forget about it, I did want to say this, and I can't remember if most of you listeners probably know I was in the Navy, but, and Josh, I can't even believe this didn't pop in my fucking mind when I was driving out to the site. So I wanted to say, basically I get to the where they actually have the visitor center and you start there and then you look at this video and you get on the bus and then the bus ride really to the site. Again, it's the middle of nowhere for reasons. Even now it's the middle of nowhere. And this was 1940, you know, 70 plus years ago. Could you imagine how middle of nowhere it was then? And it's still in the middle of nowhere. There's like one road that goes past it. And I've been on that road probably 10 times over in between, like driving for family or work or whatever have you. And never even put two and two together that if I looked out to my right and I saw the stack way the hell out there, that was the reactors. I never even put that together for whatever reason. But I will say one of the reasons, and I mean, I'm a bit sentimental here, but one of the reasons I wanted to do this tour, not only for the write-up and not only to kind of, you know, companion piece, tie everything together. And again, patrons, you're going to have the write-up initially. And it dawned on me that I was in Nagasaki in the Navy. And so we had to go to some festival that when this would have been like 90, I want to say 93, 94 timeframe, somewhere around there. But we had this festival that we were stationed in Yokosuka originally in Yokosuka, Japan. Nagasaki was a day and a half boat ride down. We pulled into the pier and this protest was already there against Americans because, you know, not everybody loves Americans, go figure. And our thing was, strange, isn't it? We were there basically for this festival and for a new museum that had just opened up in Nagasaki about the war and about the atomic weapon and what it did to the city. There's another museum in Hiroshima. And in fact, I was talking to the guy later on, the guy that was doing the tour for the most part. And he actually visited the Hiroshima Museum and was talking about that and what he saw. And I was talking about the Nagasaki Museum. So we were told, you know, being in the Navy, we were like, okay, we got to get our dress whites on and look all fancy. And all of us were required to go to the museum. Free charge, we can go. But we had to at least make a presence, like ambassadors of sorts, right? And so, you know, you're walking past these protesters dressed in your whites, feeling kind of like an asshole anyway. You know, and that's experience I never was used to because, you know, you pull into these third world countries, not saying Japan's one, but a lot of them. People love seeing the United States. It brings money. It brings, like, the bars are busy. The whorehouses are busy. No offense, but that's just, right. That's how some of these towns survive, was from us visiting these towns. Philippines is a very good example. So this was new. You know, you have these protesters out there, and they're picketing, and they got these signs. Of course, they're doing it like Japanese people usually do, very cordial. Very. Nobody's yelling at us. Nobody's throwing rocks and potatoes at us. They're just there with signs going, go home. Go home, America. You know, it was just fucking.
Yeah.
So we go up to the museum, and it was me and my buddy, and I'm walking through there, and I come on this picture. It was like a giant, like a 10 by 12. You know, they blow up the old black and whites and mount them on the wall.
Yeah.
And it was a picture of this fucking little girl, and she's got glass melted into her face, and she's crying, and it was like right after the bomb dropped, like that half day after the bomb had dropped, and they were trying to get everybody to figure out what the casualties were, which we'll cover in the second part of the write-up. It was a lot more than they had anticipated, unfortunately. Anyway, I'm looking at this picture, and next to me is this old, old Japanese guy, and I'm assuming his granddaughter, he's holding her hand, and he's 5 feet over it. He's looking at the same picture, and he looks over at me, and tears are rolling down his eyes, and I started breaking down, and I did the museum, went back to the ship, and that's where I was for the other 2 days. I had no inclination to go anywhere, see anything after that, do anything after that. And so, and I know this sounds odd, again, a little heartfelt, but so touring the Hanford, knowing that, number one, I was at Nagasaki, I saw the damage after the fact,
yeah.
The visit museum, I saw the reactions of the Japanese people there and what had happened. I can only assume either this man, you know, yes, he was old, possibly he went through it, possibly, or at least he had somebody very close to him, maybe parents that would have went through it. It would have been in that time frame. It affected him emotionally, obviously. And to know that now I'm touring the site where they made the plutonium that went into the bomb that got dropped there in Nagasaki, it was just like a full weird turnaround for me. And I don't know. I know that sounds shitty, weird, maybe sentimental, but I don't know. It just struck me. I don't know. It just struck me odd. I felt so. Anyway.
Yeah. No, that's some pretty heavy shit.
Yeah. Yeah, I you know, and again, war is horrible, but a lot of good things came out of nuclear energy, and it still does. But anyway, I just want to share that.
Well, and we can and will find a way to turn pretty much anything into a weapon.
We're the most fucking visceral people, fucking species that I've ever, like, I'm almost ashamed to be part of it, honestly. It's horrible what we do. We'd rather be angry and self-defense first than we would to find a resolve. That's just us as humans, and it's a shitty thing, shitty way to be, you know, but it is. So anyway, folks, so part two, we will cover the other two sites. We'll cover some of the other various stuff. We'll keep, again, these facts and figures are mind-blowing. And then, of course, we'll go into what actually happened with the bomb after some of the after effects of that. I might sprinkle some more Hanford tour stuff in there here and there while it's kind of fresh in my mind. Pretty amazing for the most part. But I don't know. That's part one. Josh, what do you think so far?
I think it's been great. I also think you can find us at Strange Uncles Podcast on Facebook and Instagram. We're at Strange Uncles on Twitter. You can give us your money at patreon.com/strangeuncles. We have a YouTube channel that gets stuff sometimes, you know.
fair.
But if that's your preferred way to consume podcasts, you can find us there as well.
Yep, absolutely. And you can write us at strangeuncles@gmail.com. Let us know. Give me your thoughts or if you have any ideas for topics, things that are titillating that you've just been up at nights worrying about and you want somebody to cover it the proper way. We will try to do that for you. So there you go. Part one.
Yeah, if you know who the face peelers are, let us know.
Yeah, exactly. Crazy. And we'll jump into part two next week. And Patreon, stand by for bonus content that we talked about on the side to go with all this. And that was Strange Uncles. Close the gates.